This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hello there and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, the very best bits of today's show from a Wednesday, 27th of March. What have we got for you? Well, we're talking ships and planes this morning, the Baltimore bridge collapse, what does that mean for shipping, and Boeing. New chief executive there, Tim Clark of Emirates, has been weighing in on that debate, of course, a big client of Boeing and often a vocal critic of Boeing as well. Then we've got salaries this morning, new survey out from Mercer, 4% pay rise this year for most people, they say. We're going to hear from the guy behind that report. There's a new co-working space in Dubai in a metro station, which is a first for Dubai and the RTA. The man behind it is Shahzad Bhatti. Going to hear from him. And then finally, love this interview, live from Sri Lanka. Tom was speaking to the economist Arshad Ismail. Actually, some good news for the Sri Lankan economy. It's growing. They're cutting interest rates to boost growth. And tourists are returning to the island, including Tom Urquhart, who's off there soon. He's the guy who did this interview. All that to come. First up, though, those top business stories. Well, let's get more detail on one of those top stories now, because it's a top global news story. It's also a top business story. It is the collapse of the bridge in Baltimore. Nadia Swan has stayed with us in the studio. Morning, Nadia.
Good morning, Richard.
So what do we know?
Well, we're talking about the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore in the US state of Maryland. And it's about 3 kilometres long. It's on the East Coast, and it's one of the busiest ports on the East Coast there, spanning the Patapsco River. So the timeline that we're looking at, around 1:30 yesterday morning, so Tuesday morning, a massive container ship, a Singapore-flagged container ship, the Dali, was en route to Sri Lanka. And it basically issued a mayday call saying that they were completely out of power and had lost propulsion over the ship. So that they actually radioed the authorities, and the authorities fortunately then had enough time to stop any further cars and traffic going on the bridge. Happily, it was at 1:30 in the morning, so not too much going on there. So within minutes of losing power, the ship actually crashed into one of the supports of the bridge there, and a large section of that bridge collapsed almost instantly. If you look at the video, it's really very dramatic. Now, this is how one of the residents there, Jim Wood, described the moment.
The house shook a little bit, and at first I thought it was a sonic boom from an airplane. And I've never heard a sound quite like it. It lasted for 6 to 10 seconds, and then it just indescribable.
So at the time, the only people on the bridge were some construction workers. They were filling in potholes at the time. Now, when rescue efforts were underway, they managed to rescue one person who is fortunately okay. Another person is in hospital who's critically wounded. But sadly, 6 other people, construction workers who were on the bridge, haven't been found. Now, at the moment, they've said that the rescue efforts are being called off because it's too dangerous for rescue workers to do that. So they are unfortunately presumed dead. But the search for bodies will then resume in the early hours of this morning. They spent 18 hours looking for them. There were 22 crew members on board the vessel. It had 10,000 cargo containers on that ship as well. And as you've obviously pointed out on the Business Breakfast, a really busy and important bridge. Amazon has a warehouse over there. And experts are saying it's essentially the closest thing to the Suez Canal the Suez Canal for shipping. And there's nowhere else on the East Coast that can take that level of cargo. So basically everything goes through that port, from cars to toothbrushes. If you buy it on Amazon, it essentially goes through that port. There were 30,000 cars that crossed the bridge daily. 15,000 jobs at the port and bridge depend on this as well. So it's going to be out of action for several months, though. The exact timeline of how long it's going to take to rebuild, it's obviously not going to be weeks, because it's a very deep part of the river. So obviously all the debris that's there is going to take quite a long time to clear. Now, President Biden has been speaking, and he said that reconstruction will be paid for from federal funds.
We're going to send all the federal resources they need as we respond to this emergency. And I mean all the federal resources. And we're going to rebuild that port together. Everything so far indicates that this was a terrible accident.
So now, interestingly, that same ship, by the way, that was involved in this incident was involved in another incident in the port of Antwerp in Belgium in 2016, and that hit a quay as it tried to exit the North Sea container terminal. So clearly there's going to be a lot of questions being asked and investigations as to what actually happened to cause that horrific accident there.
Nadia Swan, thank you very much indeed. More details on the Aero News Centre app on that and other stories. But Brandy, picking up on one of the points that Nadia mentioned there, could this be another Suez Canal. First and foremost, of course, this is a human tragedy with six people missing, presumed dead. But we are the Business Breakfast. We do live in one of the world's major port shipping freight logistics centres. And the question is being asked, is this yet another blow to the global shipping infrastructure industry?
Yeah, and that is the question that producer Mo has been asking the man with the data, Matt Stanley, Partnerships Lead for the Middle East at Kepler, who measure these sort of things. They say that 20 vessels currently stuck because of the incident. Matt's been explaining to Mo what it could mean for shipping.
It was a container ship, the MV Dali, collided with a pillar, caused the bridge to collapse. It must have gone in there at some speed. There were eight rescue boats that came from the port of Baltimore. It's a major container port in the States. We've got a total of 23 vessels that are going to be stuck that side of the bridge. Obviously, the most important thing is the rescuing of anyone unfortunately stranded in the water. If there is anyone, it's still sort of a developing story. It's a main sugar terminal. It's a main coal terminal. 22 of the boats are on dry cargo. So that's sugar, minerals, metals, forest products, fertilizers, etc., etc.
Now, he also has been outlining which markets will be affected in both the short term, but also the long term by the incident.
It will have an effect on the coal market for sure, because, you know, just where it is logistically, it will be more difficult to in and out. It will, of course, you know, impact on dry cargo for sure. Oil won't be affected. Otherwise, infrastructure in the States is so developed that, you know, could truck around. But the dry cargo for sure. You know, just put it into context, 22 million tonnes of coal was exported from that terminal last year. So even a 2-week blip in infrastructure, it's going to have a profound effect on flows from there.
Matt Stanley there, Partnerships Lead for the Middle East at Kepler. From ships to aeroplanes, Tom, the fallout from the departure of Dave Calhoun from Boeing continues. We had the news breaking on Monday. We covered it in depth on Tuesday. We heard from him, Dave Calhoun. But his clients have been having their say over the past 24 hours, none more so than Tim Clark here in Dubai at Emirates.
Yep, Tim Clark's been talking to various news outlets, including The National right here in the UAE. Some strong comments from Sir Tim, who basically reiterates the fact that Boeing needs a strong engineering lead, was his big phrase, after the chief exec has stepped down, along with the chairman and the chief commercial as well. But went on to say that only time will tell if said management changes will resolve the problems facing the US plane maker. Emirates, obviously, are beholden to all things Boeing, and Sir Tim has been fairly forthright with a few comments in the past with regards to the deliveries from Boeing. He has made a number of interesting comments, as I said, both to the National, the FT, and others as well. This is what he said to the National. It's little wonder that the Machinist Union wants a seat on the board simply to ensure that the voice of the factory floor is part and parcel of the decision process and is fully integrated into the governance model's risk management strategies. Whether yet again this changing of the guard will resolve Boeing's issues, only time will tell. But time, unfortunately, is not on their side. So some bold comments coming through from Sir Tim.
I tried.
Sir Tim Clark and bold comment shocker?
Well, exactly, yes. He is. He's a great airline executive and has done wonderful things for the industry in this city.
But he's also a really good quote.
He's a gift for journalists. He really is. So good morning, Tim, if you're listening.
Sir Tim to you.
Sorry. Right. Anthony's pulled me up. I tried to jump to the defence of Boeing. Not easy, I know, at the moment. But I made the point that, okay, Boeing's getting a lot of flack for putting profits before safety, for accelerating the production line of the 737 MAX too quickly to meet demand, and perhaps that resulted in the Alaska Airlines panel blowout. I made the point that, well, the delays to the 777X, which Tim Clark and Emirates have been irate about for some time now, is that not evidence that Boeing doesn't always put speed and profit before safety? The fact that the 777X is delayed is because Boeing is putting safety before profit. Anthony writes in, no, Thanks, Anthony. Morning to you too. He said it is the FAA, the regulator, that's holding back the 777, not Boeing. I don't know if that's true or not, but Anthony, thanks very much indeed for getting in touch.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Right, we're looking at what might happen to salaries and hiring this year. Taking a sneak peek at the deck from Mercer when it comes to their latest remuneration survey. Very pleased to be joined by Middle East Careers Principal Vlad Vroskov. I've done it again. Vroskovsky, morning, Vlad. How
morning.
Are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Right, let's get into the numbers. I might be slightly better at that. 4% rise in the UAE on average you guys are predicting. What's that on the back of?
That's pretty much very standard for this region. We've seen 4% or the range between 3.5 and 4.5 at best and worst probably throughout a long period of time. So 4%, it might be mostly on the back of good economic drivers, diverse economy, and quite a lot of movement in the market as well.
How does it compare to what we've seen over the last few years?
It looks like it's quite stable. It's quite steady, which is a positive signal from what I see. It seems that there's a lot of confidence in the economy, and employers are willing to invest more into salary increases, invest more into bonuses, and that sort of is driving that interest in retention as well, and sort of kind of like helping employees feel a bit more secure when it comes to their jobs.
What does it look like though when we take inflation into account?
Well, I think that the main question is going to be which inflation, right? Or what number of inflation. Typically in our study, we use IMF inflation, which could be a bit lower than what the U.S. Central Bank has reported. But that's mostly for consistency reasons, because this is a global study, and we're trying to actually keep our sources consistent. If we use the IMF figures, which is up 2.3% inflation and 4% salary increase, we are sort of at par. Knowing that we apply the salary increase only on the basic portion of the salary, not on the guaranteed portion of the salary. So we would be more or less in line with inflation looking at that number.
Okay. You mentioned confidence of employers there. And yet, if I get to slide 15 of your deck, I look at what's expected in headcount changes for 2024. And it doesn't look very confident at all. You've got 76% of employers that you've spoken to here in the UAE saying that they expect headcount this year to stay the same, 8% to decrease it. That's the vast majority who say we're either not going to hire new people or we're going to either let go or let natural churn take its course.
Yeah. So I think that we could also look at, you know, how many of them would be increasing, right? So if we add up
16%.
Those numbers, 16%, right? So it's double than what would be decreasing. However, what's the interesting part of it is it's more about talking about new jobs, adding more jobs to the organizations. And again, if we're looking at average, and this is all average across industries, if we slice that data across sectors, that data might look a bit different. Obviously.
Okay, but I am just going to press down on that though, because given the buoyancy that we're feeling in the economy at the moment, for 76% to say we're not going to be adding any new jobs seems really high.
I think that's been quite standard, by the way. I think that there is not a massive expansion. So what we've been building on for the past couple of years, let's say post-COVID, has been a steady increase in demand, a steady increase in output, economic output, a steady increase in margin and profit, right? So what we see is that companies are sort of looking at how they optimize and how they get the best productivity of their current workforce rather than just adding new workforce.
Did it surprise you?
It doesn't, for a couple of reasons. AI is slowly creeping in our workplace, and it's sort of helping us with productivity gains. We also see a bit more interest in a lot of companies looking at a bit of outsourcing into cheaper markets, different parts of the population. There was a bit of a discussion just before me on gig working and working at contractors. So we're looking at that kind of like workforce flexibility slowly starting to increase. And that might be some of the reasons of why we don't see a very bullish kind of like hiring intentions from employers.
Okay, well, let's look at Saudi Arabia, which is a big hirer of talent at the moment. What are you seeing there in terms of incentives and pay to keep that talent?
Yeah, so I think that Saudi is working on two aspects here, right? First is really attract talent that they need to reach their 2030 goals. And the second aspect is ensure that whoever they attract stays there to be able to get to those goals, right? So we see a lot of movement when it comes to long-term incentive plans, which are sort of picking up a bit more in the region. We see that bonuses are getting a bit more prevalent in the pay structures. And that sort of indicates that, you know, there is quite heavy interest in actually getting the top talent that is available in the market. And then as they bring in, try to retain them as long as possible.
But you've still got about 75% of employers that you've spoken to in Saudi saying our headcount's going to stay the same.
Yeah, yeah. Again, I think it's more of when you average out, this is a large group of employers, right? So we're looking at 700-800 companies participating in the survey. Looking at averages, we're not going to see, really see like large differences between in the averages. Across industries, though, that might be a bit different.
And you've got a 4.2% salary increase for Saudi.
Yeah.
Again, anecdotally feels a bit higher. Are we just getting carried away with stories of big numbers, and is it actually quite moderate on the ground?
I think it's a good question, by the way, but I think it's not as moderate as we want to. Depends on where. I mean, we don't want to be moderate, right? We want to be more dynamic, obviously. But what's more interesting is that these two markets are getting very competitive, right? And we see that sort of the talent models are shifting a bit. So we're looking at really highly technical skills, jobs that are able to really contribute a lot to the value chains of different companies, right? And that's where we start paying for talent, right? That's where we start paying for this highly scarce talent that is going to drive the output and the productivity of the organizations. But at the same time, that's quite scarce because pretty much everyone in the world is competing for the same talent pool these days.
Okay, we've got 30 seconds left with you. You pointed out that as an average, some sectors will be higher. Which sectors are going to be the wage winners this year?
Life sciences, financial services, consumer goods are kind of like driving the markets. Where we see a bit of a lack is still the technology side, still catching up from the troubles that they've been in. However, these two, three sectors are kind of like really making headwinds these days.
Vlad Vorosky is the Middle East's career principal at Mercer, coming in to talk to us about what they're forecasting we'll see in salaries and in hiring and firing this year. Thanks for your time.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast,
where we are looking in more detail one of our top stories this morning, and that is the RTA moving into the co-working space. They're setting up a communal work spot in Bergerman Metro Station. They're going to start a pilot project next month and partnering with the guys from the co-spaces to do it. We are joined by the founder, Shahzad Bahati. He's in the studio at the moment. It's lovely to see you.
Hi, lovely to see you. Thanks for having me.
So tell me what you guys are setting up down in Bir Dubai.
Yes, I mean, it's something super interesting. And I think, you know, with the support of the RTA, we're one of the first urban metro networks to actually try something like this around the world. We were approached last year by the RTA looking to build a more engaging environment within their metro stations. People are passing by metro stations and through metro stations. So they reached out to us with an idea of building a network of co-working spaces, which were easily accessible through the Dubai line. So we've built the first location, which is in Bergerman Metro Station, which is our pilot project. And it's an interesting concept with, you know, to have a flexible workspace within the network.
Okay, so let's break that down. What have you actually built in there? How big is it? What's in it?
So this first location is approximately 4,000 square feet. We have a range of private offices, desk spaces, meeting rooms, as well as lounges and breakout areas for people to work from.
And where exactly in the metro station is it?
So in the metro station, in the underground ticket hall, it's in one of the retail locations there.
Okay. And how is it going to work?
So it's one of those concepts where it's still a trial. So the idea, what we want to achieve is to get more people using the metro's network. Obviously, you know, we can go and see how the Dubai traffic has changed significantly in the past year. And ultimately, people are finding it very difficult to get to work on time and to use a workspace when they need to use it. So one of the solutions we've built here is to make it easily accessible, especially during those summer months where people are then deciding to take a taxi or to take other modes of transport, which increases the number of cars on the road.
many people could fit in at once?
So in this location, we can have approximately 70 people at one time, 70 seats.
And how much are they going to be paying to use it?
So we have a number of different memberships. It can start as simple as 30 dirhams a day for a day pass, and that would give them access to the desk spaces, the lounges. We have the meeting rooms, which can be booked by the hour, or we have more regular monthly memberships for the co-working memberships and the private offices.
Would you have to be a member to use it, or can you just drop in?
Anyone with a Knoll card, or if they prefer to pay directly with a normal card, they can pop in, take a day pass and start using the facility immediately.
And a day is 9 to 5, 24 hours?
A day is 7 a.m. to 8 p.m.
Okay. So you're opening in April on a trial basis. What's the success of that trial going to be based on?
So it will be based on how quickly, well, not how quickly, how much we can fill it up. So we have industry standards internationally of co-working spaces around about 60 to 70%. Our location in downtown Dubai, which is our first location, is currently at 95% occupancy rate per annum. So our objective for this new location is anything above 70% occupancy would be marked as a success in our personal opinion.
And if it does work, this one becomes permanent?
If it does work, this one becomes permanent, and then we can discuss with the RTA building more spaces throughout the network, which then makes it easier where if you have staff who are spread out the city, having access or a membership to our spaces will allow all of them to access the closest workspace to them.
How many could you have? In the discussions you've had with the RTA, what other stations have you said, okay, maybe this, maybe that, maybe this, and how big?
So the ones that we're very keen on are obviously the ones which are the interchange ones. So I think there's a Jebel Ali metro station. They've also proposed the Dubai Expo metro station. So there's many interesting options as the city grows and as we see the population move around. That will also guide us on which metro stations make the most sense.
Why, if I was just a bit stuck on a busy day, would I want to work from within the metro station rather than popping outside, sitting in a Starbucks or a Costa or a wherever else, getting a coffee and setting up my laptop there?
Yeah, I mean, many people do start off with, you know, working from a cafe, working from a Starbucks. But ultimately, when you start moving into building a team, working with a team, cafes aren't really a suitable environment. So that's when you really need dedicated spaces, whether it's a meeting room, whether it's a private offices, or whether it's just a nice quiet space where two or three of you, or even on your own, can work together in an environment where you also have an opportunity to network and meet with other, you know, like-minded entrepreneurs.
When I think of a transport hub, I think of bustle, I think of noise, I think of thousands of people streaming in and out. How are you going to make that pleasant?
Yes, we've actually had to install very special glass in the shop front, which absorbs a lot of the noise. But I'll be honest with you, I had the same impression. But when you do walk through Burj Aman, there's kind of a calming buzz in the train hall, as opposed to, you know, one of the busiest stations in London, for example. So that's quite interesting, I found, with the Dubai Metro network, which is unusual.
And who do you think are going to be the people using it?
So definitely people within the area, within the Burj Aman area and the few stations around them, and people who are visiting Dubai, business travellers who may be staying in hotels within the Burj Aman area also.
In your own expansion, because this is one of the things that you guys do for a business, is set up flexible workspaces, you're at 90% capacity in your downtown space at the mm-hmm. moment. What are you looking to do next?
So we are obviously looking at expanding, but you know, we don't want to oversaturate the market. We can see what's happened with the co-working and flexible workspace industry in New York and in London. And there are, you know, in my opinion, quite a lot of workspace providers there. So we're looking at everything with a pinch of salt. We're looking at other Emirates in the UAE, which makes more sense than oversaturating Dubai itself.
And before I let you go, 30 seconds, one of the other things you guys do is as a business setup hub, you help people get ajaris and visas and all the rest of it. Will you be offering those services in
yes.
the metro space?
Yes. So with as a business incubator, we'll be providing a more affordable, flexible ways for startups to launch and license their businesses, as well as the educational mentorship programs that we run to support their specific industries.
And when's it going live?
We're hoping by the end of April. Fingers crossed, subject to approval.
Well, you're working with the bosses of the Metro, so I'm guessing exactly. that's not going to be too tricky.
I hope so, but there's still protocol to follow.
Shahzad Bahati is the partner, is the founder of the partner of the RTA for their co-working spaces. The Co-Spaces is the name of the company. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Right, we're off to Sri Lanka now as we continue to focus on some of the big economies of the region. And obviously the Sri Lankan economy has taken a number of hits recently. But yesterday, Sri Lanka's central bank lowering its interest rates by 50 basis points in what was a wholly unexpected move as it focuses on boosting growth prospects to steer the island nation out of what has been its worst financial crisis in decades. Central Bank of Sri Lanka reducing the standing deposit facility rate to 8.5%, standing lending facility rate 9.5%. Let's get some analysis on this one from senior research analyst at Frontier Research, live from Colombo. It's a good morning and a welcome to the show to Arshad Ishmael. Arshad, thanks so much indeed for your time.
Yes, a very good morning to you as well. Thank you.
A lot of media reporting this as a surprising move. Surprising to you?
I'd say, yes, it's not something that a lot of people from the market would have expected. But again, I would say it's not an outlier as well. It was coming at one point. So I think it's not a big surprise, but yes, a little too early.
Central Bank now slashing interest rates by a total 700 basis points since last year. We know the basis from which that has come, you know, painful recovery, obviously in process. But is this signs of recovery?
I feel yes. So if you look at Sri Lanka in the past, let's say 5 years, we've had negative growth. The economy has contracted in 4 out of 5. So I think it's high time that the economy actually recovers, actually GDP starts picking up. We did see recent data also facilitating this. Q4 GDP of 2023 finally showed some sort of positive growth of around 4.5%. So that, I think, is some sort of positive sign. And going to an election year, the government will also want to continue this momentum. So I think this rate cut comes from that recovery perspective.
We have, however, seen growth. I mean, 6 successive quarters of negative growth. But Sri Lanka's economy estimated to record a growth of 4.5% year on year, fourth quarter of last year, according to the latest reports from the central bank there. Those green shoots of recovery certainly seem to be more pressing and more obvious now.
Yes, true enough. So I think one main factor that brings in this recovery is also the controlled inflation that's out there. So from highs of around 70%, the country has been able to bring inflation down to around a 4-5% range. And that's what I think the central bank will also expect going forward in 2024. So if you can keep inflation under control, I think many other factors also automatically fall into play.
And in terms of that inflation rate, what's the target?
So what the central bank has actually announced right now is to keep inflation at a mid-single digit, close to around a 5% is what they say. But there could be slight variations of around maybe going up to around a 7, maybe down to like a 3%. And currently, the latest inflation reading, according to the Colombo Consumer Price Index, we saw inflation reading at around a 5.9% in February. And according to a few analysis that I've done as well personally, I feel inflation in March, which will most likely be out by tomorrow, the CCPI-based inflation, could actually come down with higher base effects, with electricity tariffs being reduced. That has been a major driver, the currency appreciating, so most of the imports actually being more affordable to Sri Lanka. So all of these factors, I feel, given the calculations that I've done, looks like inflation would come down to around 2-3% in March. But again, that would be a slight uptick. But however, the risks of inflation going out of hand has kind of been minimized. So that's something that actually drove this policy rate cut.
Sri Lankan rupee, you just mentioned there. Let's have a look at the financials if we can. Good year last year, appreciated just over 12% against the US dollar. Has that continued in the early part in Q1 of 2024?
Yes, definitely. So if you look at the currency in Q1 of 2024, actually the currency has kind of, maybe up to date, has appreciated close to around 6.7%. And has been, the Sri Lankan rupee has been one of the most top performing currencies out there. So mainly I would say, foreign inflows coming in, even the market sentiment in terms of the positive progress with the IMF program, especially tourism inflows has been the season. That's December, January, February has seen a lot of tourists also coming into Sri Lanka. Worker remittances have stayed good. Exports have stayed resilient. And given that external debt restructuring has not yet been finalized, the outflows have kind of been minimized. So all of these factors together have contributed to the rupee performing very well. There is, I think, space for it to maybe go down a little, but that could hurt exporters. We'll see how things would play out.
Everything you have said to us this morning seems positive, Arshad, which is brilliant news to all of our listeners here in the UAE. Are you feeling that sentiment? Obviously, the numbers are one side of it, but do you get the sense of optimism on the streets of Colombo and across Sri Lanka?
I think yes. I think the people are also feeling it, even though maybe cost of living has not really come down significantly. I feel people are feeling feeling some sort of confidence. They do. The positive momentum is out there. The exporters are exporting confidently. You have the importers trying to bring down. You've seen certain electronic items going on sale with the appreciation of the currency. So all of that, yes, has contributed, and Sri Lanka is preparing for its Sinhala and Tamil New Year in April. And however, there's a risk that we will have to be looking out for. That is the elections that might show up somewhere around towards the latter part. That's a risk. But however, yes, there has been a lot of positive sentiment in the country itself.
Let's talk about the bilateral relations between Sri Lanka and the UAE. UAE currently the seventh, or rather the eighth, export destination for Sri Lanka at the moment. Obviously, relations, diplomatic relations between the two established well back in the 1970s as well. From your reading of the numbers, still strong connections between the UAE and Sri Lanka?
Yes, I think that the government has also, that's one priority of the government as well recently, to improve these relations. I think there has been a lot of positive moves, even with the president announcing things publicly in forums. So the relationship, I feel, has improved, and UAE has not just been one of Sri Lanka's export markets. It has also been one of the prominent worker remittance inflow markets to Sri Lanka. So yes, I think the relationship has been doing good.
Final one for all of our listeners, and I'll admit a little bit selfishly here in the studio as well. You mentioned the word tourism earlier. The latest numbers from what you're seeing on the ground, the evidence that you see, is tourism back to the levels that it was previously?
I'd say it's recovering, but it's not yet. I think tourism in Sri Lanka peaked in 2018, where we had close to around 2.5 million tourists visiting, and that brought in a lot of inflows. So currently we are on track. We are on track to probably reach close to around 2 million arrivals. So it's still a little less than what we would have had in our peak. We've so far recorded 500,000 tourist arrivals. Spending, however, has comparatively fallen. If you look at what tourists were spending back in 2018 to what they're spending now, the average spend of a tourist has fallen. But however, it's gradually rising. Arrivals are upticking. So I think we are headed towards the right path, even though we have not yet surpassed our highs in 2018.
Arshad, really appreciate your time. Thank you so much indeed for your time this morning. Arshad Ismail is the Senior Research Analyst, Frontier Research, live from Colombo.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com. You've been listening to a DubaiEye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from DubaiEye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.